A few years ago, I found a really weird cash point. This cash point took my money, and in return, I got a QR code that taught me a little bit about how to use a Bitcoin wallet. Since I made that really small investment, I learned a little bit about how the system worked, but nothing more. I can honestly say I never really understood what I was doing or how the thing worked. In this second episode of LDN, London Digital Nattering, I'm joined by Sunny Dilgeer. Sunny started out as a curious reader on the subject of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Later, he started to invest in this interesting asset class. He surfed the turbulent waves of the market that peaked around Christmas last year, 2017, and, to his credit, stayed on his surfboard. Sunny and I are going to talk about how Bitcoin works and what the future holds. And, appropriately for this subject, our secondary topic in this podcast is going to be gambling. As usual, you can find show notes on www.ldnpodcast.com. Get in touch or follow us on Twitter at @LDNpodcast. And for now, sit back, enjoy the show. Hi, Sunny. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing, Kieran?
Oh, I'm good, mate. I'm good. Thank you. So this podcast is LDN, so London Digital Nattering, but you're not actually in London at the moment, which is why you're joining me over a Skype call.
Uh-huh. I am in slightly sunny Birmingham, by the canal, and I can see two ducks waiting to quack their regular evening quack, as they do.
Are they usually on the hour and the half hour, or what happens?
It's normally between 8 and half 8, so let's pray that they don't make a guest appearance.
Oh, it would be pretty cool if they did. So just for those listening and wondering why LDN is talking to somebody in whatever the three-letter acronym is for Birmingham. The reason is, dear listeners, is that Sunny and I used to work together a lot in London and occasionally together in Birmingham, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah. So, many moons ago.
Yeah. Well, 2017 is that many moons ago? Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah.
I guess it is. Yeah. Yeah. So good. Well, hey, thanks for really very much for making the time to join me on the podcast. And our chosen subject is Bitcoin today.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So I found a Bitcoin ATM a few years ago, and it was really weird, and I put some money into it, and then it gave me this QR code. It's like a barcode, and I scanned it into my phone, and there I am. I have Bitcoin, and suddenly I might be able to spend it on the internet, but I just know that I threw some money into a machine, and then I got something I didn't really understand at the time. So for the benefit of the people on the podcast who are maybe new to the topic, have heard about it, what the hell is Bitcoin?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So, Bitcoin is effectively a digital currency which is made using open source software and freely licensed encryption techniques which create Bitcoins. And those techniques are also used to verify the transfer of Bitcoins from wallet to wallet. Bitcoin also operates independently of financial institutions, central banks, any kind of intermediaries. So it's a borderless means of transferring value. And for that reason, it's known as the world's first decentralized digital currency, and it's trustless.
So that's the thing that still confuses me, I guess, is that it's a decentralized currency. But you know, I didn't do brilliantly economics A level, I guess. But I know enough to know that you need a central bank, presumably. Like we have the Bank of England here, and so. So how does it work then, having a decentralized currency? Presumably that means there is no central bank for this currency. How does that work?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a bit like VoIP, actually. voice over internet protocol. So you can call someone and not have to call through an intermediary. And so with regards to Bitcoin, Bitcoin is now being known as MOIP, Money Over Internet Protocols. So whereby value is transferred peer-to-peer. So you can open up a Bitcoin wallet if you go on a Bitcoin exchange, or if you go use some open source website, you can buy some Bitcoin and you can move it from your wallet to another wallet that's held by somebody else without the need to wait for, say, a central machine to process the movement or the settlement of that Bitcoin. So it's you, person A, sending Bitcoin to person B, and the a bunch of miners compete to on the Bitcoin network to do the complicated encryption calculation to win some Bitcoin as a reward to move your money.
Yeah. So that still blows my mind. So there's not actually like a central server involved, right?
No.
So that blows my mind. I think a bit later on we're going to talk in more detail about the mechanics of how the thing works, because I have to confess, I still don't quite get it. I kind of get that it's a kind of a currency, but isn't a bankable currency. There's no bank, right? And you mentioned a word earlier, trustless. What does that mean?
So you don't have to rely on anyone to move your funds across, because there is competition in the network that so participants in the Bitcoin network are incentivized to send your money over to somebody else and do the calculation within secure encryption techniques, which haven't been broken so far. So you don't have to trust anyone because it's processed by game theory and unbreakable encryption techniques.
Game theory as well. Right, okay. So, all right, we'll probably cover that a bit more around the mechanics of how it works. But, I mean, we have money, right? So I have a credit card. I can use it pretty much anywhere in the world. I can carry money in my wallet or in my pocket. I can use that for things. You know, when I was a kid, I lost a tooth. I got money. I've got this. There's this thing in the world called money. And why? What was the problem that people were trying to solve with Bitcoin? So what was the use case? Why did somebody... Clearly, people have put a lot of work into this and there's a lot of buzz. Is it some kind of scam, or is there a proper kind of like real philosophical reason why it exists?
Yeah. So I'd have to kind of slightly go back into time, if that's okay, to give you a bit of context. Yeah.
Go on then. I like a bit of history.
Cool. So I'll have to kind of explain this thing called the Mandrake mechanism. So I don't know how old you are, Kieron, to know this, but in the 40s, 1940s.
Oh, in the 40s, how old am I?
Sorry, that was a joke.
I know I might be asking questions about Bitcoin like I'm someone's granddad, but I certainly wasn't born in the 40s. But yeah, cool.
So in the 1940s, there was a comic strip character called Mandrake the Magician. And so, so Mandrake's specialty was creating things out of nothing, and when appropriate, making them disappear back into the same void.
Okay, so he could pull things out of thin air, and then he could make them disappear. basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
That was a mandrake. So just remember that magician as I kind of narrate the history a little bit.
Okay.
Cool. So in 1910, a group of about six men met on an island in Georgia, in the United States, called Jekyll Island.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a bit like Jekyll and Hyde.
Oh, right, and, yeah.
Yeah, and so these six men had a premise. There was a big underlying reason for them to meet. So they basically met in total secrecy, and this wasn't known to the media. It wasn't known to their family or friends. And the details of this weren't shared until 20 years later in some of their biographies. So these men were threatened by too much competition in the 19th century around a lot of local and regional banks opening up in America and kind of making a lot of profits and commissions over trades at the time. And what's interesting to know is that these six men represented 25% of the world's wealth when they met.
The world's wealth?
Yes, the world's wealth.
Blimey.
Yeah. And so they met, and their main motivation was that they thought that the solution to get rid of all this competition was to form an oligopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came out once again in a lot of secrecy. They came out in separate trains and carriages so that they didn't have to kind of just stay away from the limelight still. And basically 3 years later, the agenda that they came with Jekyll Island, they eventually got their way, and they formed this institution. But do you know what this institution is called?
I'm guessing it's the Fed.
Yes, exactly.
These six people who had a quarter of the world's wealth, that still blows my mind. Even nowadays, when we've got Buffett, Gates, Bezos and that lot,
mm-hmm.
that still blows my mind. Wow. I mean, so things really don't change, do they?
Yeah. I've got a friend, and me and him, we always share this saying that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Yeah, exactly. So... interesting. So basically they created an oligopoly, as you said, which is like a limited like a limited competition type marketplace, right? Is that
yes.
what we mean by that? Right. So, and this created the Fed. So how did that create the Fed?
So the Fed had an arrangement with the United States government, and this model's been applied many times before the Fed was created, actually.
So you're telling me these six guys, it still blows my mind, these six guys, quarter of the world's wealth, created this limited cabal of competition called the Fed. And but how is that even possible? Because the impression that I always had, and I guess a lot of people had, was that this is actually a government department of some kind. Are you saying it's not?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I can't remember the original name that they wanted to give it. I think they wanted to give it a very corporate name. But during the discussions on Jekyll Island, they obviously realized that it would give away the fact that this is a private entity, which is why they had a few debates and then they came up with the U.S. Federal Reserve. So that's how the Federal Reserve did the idea of the United States central banking system was founded.
Okay. So just so I'm really clear, so they're the central bank. It's a private company, and they issue the dollar, right?
Yes.
So a private company issues the dollar, but everybody, certainly I'd imagine everybody thinks that the dollar is issued by the US government and not by a private company. I know this feels like a massive rabbit hole. I'm sure you're going to, like, in a minute, we're going to find out why Mandrake is important, the magician. But so this is the thing I'm struggling to wrap my head around. You're telling us that the dollar that has Lincoln on it, Benjamin, Washington, you know, that has these heads of state is actually issued by the Federal Reserve, which is a private company and not the government of the US.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Wow. Okay. So they're quite literally making money.
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, I can. I remember a transcript I read between the governor of the Federal Reserve in, this was in 1941. So this is a transcript between the governor of the Federal Reserve called a Mr. Marina Eccles and a congressman at the time called Wright Patman.
Right.
It's a very simple, very short conversation transcript, but it's kind of the highlight of is the reason why I got into this entire space, and how I'll explain how it goes into Bitcoin as well. Would you like me to read it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if this is for me, I mean, what's interesting about these podcasts, talking to people who do this stuff, I really actually want to know at some stage not just how this thing works, but how on earth you got tangled up in it. But yeah, maybe this will reveal the answer.
Sure. Okay. So the Great Depression, as some of us know, there was a big Great Depression in the United States in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And following this depression, Marina Eccles, who was the governor of the Federal Reserve, was asked to give testimony for the House Committee on Banking and Currency, just so that they could explain the Federal Reserve's role in the Great Depression of the 1930s. So I'm just going to read this very quick excerpt.
All right.
So it starts with the Fed governor, Marina.
Mm-hmm.
"We created it." Congress Patman. "Out of what?" The Fed governor. "Out of the right to issue credit money." The congressman. "And there is nothing behind it, is there? Except our government's credit?" The Fed governor. "That's what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money."
If there were no debts, there'd be no money. So money is therefore debt, is what we're saying.
Yes.
Right. So, okay, that's quite a big thing to wrap the head around.
Yeah.
I'm saying that a lot on this podcast, Sonny.
It's the reason I got very, very massively distracted towards cryptocurrencies and just central banking in general. I still, to this day, find it a fascinating subject. Because so it drives just all the decisions across the world, and it's such a powerful concept. Carry on.
So that means if money is debt, hang on, let me just get my head around this. So money is created by the issue of debt. Is that how that works?
Yeah. So basically money is not created until the instant that it's borrowed.
Uh-huh.
So say I am the owner of, let's just say, Bank X. And Bank X has got £100 in its deposits. But using fractional reserve banking concepts, you are allowed to issue, I think it's, forgive me for inaccuracies here, but I think you can issue up to 9 times the deposit that you hold.
Yeah.
So I can issue out £900 in loans on top of £100 that I hold as a reserve. But so my total assets would become £1,000. But it's only £1,000 if you borrow that £900 from me, because basically it's the act of borrowing that causes that £900 to spring into existence.
Right.
And so my assets are £1,000 only because you borrowed £900 from me. And conversely, it's the act of paying off that debt that also causes that money supply to vanish. So if you pay off that loan, that £900 disappears from the system.
Okay, so if I understand it correctly, I'm a bank. Sorry, you're a bank. You've got £100.
Yeah.
I borrow 900. You issue me a loan of £900.
Mm-hmm.
So now the total money supply is £1,000.
Yes.
So, and I want to pay you that £900 back.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you'll send the bailiffs after my car that somehow existed without a money supply in the first place. And so I want to pay you that £900 back. But the only way I'm going to be able to pay you that £900 back is if somebody else pays me that £900 to pay to you, right?
Voila.
So, and not only that, you're probably hitting me with interest.
Uh-huh.
So for argument's sake, I don't owe you 900, I owe you 1,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now we need £100 to come out of nowhere, which is presumably being issued to other schmucks who are now in debt, right? Okay. So you're a bank, you've got £100 in the bank, I can borrow 900, I then go and work my butt off to get that £900 or £1,000 to pay you back. What have you actually done to earn that money?
Nothing. I have done absolutely nothing.
Apart from managing a really big spreadsheet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that... Okay. That is that's the story of banking, legacy banking.
So I'm sure that, you know, people with the best will in the world and the greatest respect to you will listen to this and they'll think, yeah, right. I mean, he's just some schmuck on a small starting off podcast that, you know, why on earth should I take his word for it? What could people be reading to inform themselves about this? Because this, I'd be honest, you know, it does feel a little bit conspiracy theory.
You can try and understand how the United States Federal Reserve works. I'm sure they have their workings depicted on their website, actually.
Okay.
Maybe it's worth trying to read up on fractional reserve banking, mm-hmm. fractional reserve lending.
We'll put some links up in the show notes.
Mm, yeah, sure.
I'll do that later on our site, which is ldnpodcast.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter on @ldnpodcast. Sorry to do the plug, Sonny.
That's all right.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So that's real money, right? So you've kind of disabused me of this notion that I've got money in my pocket. I sound a bit like Alanis Morissette. I've got money in my pocket and I can go and do stuff with it. So rightly or wrongly, regardless of how legitimately it's created, because it doesn't sound massively legitimate if I take what you're telling me at face value, regardless of how legitimately it's created, it's still accepted, right? So given that there's all this history with Mandrake, and we need to come back to Mandrake, actually, tell me about Mandrake, and then please tell me what is the problem that the guys who invented, whoever it is who invented Bitcoin, was trying to solve.
Yeah, so the Mandrake mechanism is basically saying that it's an analogy to the creation of money. So Mandrake the magician could create things out of nothing and put them back into the make them disappear.
Right.
And it's the same principle with the current financial system, the debt-based system. So money's not created until it's borrowed. So you've borrowed it. When you pay it back, that money vanishes. And that is the Mandrake mechanism.
Got it.
Yeah.
Except it's slightly worse, no? Because money is created, then it disappears. But it actually, it leaves a distortion in, like, if we want to get all sci-fi, the space-time continuum, doesn't it? Because back to that £900 that I borrowed from you, I've now got to go and try and find that extra £100 from somewhere. We've created like a hunger. I don't want to say debt, but we've created a hunger in the system now for that £100. I've got to get that off someone else.
Exactly.
So is this how we get crashes? Presumably, so at some point, the system just falls in on itself.
Yes. Now, I don't know the I haven't studied monetary economics that deeply to understand what causes crashes, but you're exactly right. It's that distortion that you picked up on. I picked this up in 2008 when I was at uni, when I was studying for my computer science degree. I picked up that distortion that you have to pay interest on your debt. Where does this interest come from? And this this is why I got fascinated by the real money that was used many, many centuries ago, which was, you know, physical metals and precious metals and commodities. So this money system is how the world works, and this money system in the United States is currently valued. This debt that we call money is valued at $21 trillion. So that's $21,000 billion.
Right, and that can never be paid off, presumably. That'll never get paid off.
Yeah, because the government has to borrow to pay a debt that it can't service. And that debt is growing faster and faster until it starts growing exponentially.
We've set the stage with the Mandrake effect. So what is the problem, back to that question, that Bitcoin is trying to solve?
Sure. So ever since the central banking system took shape from 1913 onwards, we've had a series of booms and busts.
Yeah.
Every dozen or so years, every 10, 15 years, there's been booms and busts because that banking system is also in Europe. And we had the big dot-com bubble, and then we had the Great Recession in 2008-2009. And I think what happened is some people had tried to make a digital version of money back in the 90s. And one chap called Hal Finney tried to make a DigiCash, but he got too greedy and asked for quite a lot of money from a very big IT vendor, and that never took off. And then the internet
was that the same idea as Bitcoin, or was that something else?
It had some similar properties to Bitcoin, yes.
Okay.
And then another chap tried to make something called BitGold.
Right.
And then in 2008, by 2008-2009, the internet, that there was enough knowledge and skill in the IT space for a bunch of guys to get together and do something about all the booms and busts they had seen. So effectively, what happened in 2008 and 9 is that a bunch of cryptographers, so people who work on security, a bunch of economists, they all got together and worked to create a more mature version of the DigiCash that Hal Finney created about 15, 20 years ago. And this thing was called Bitcoin, And the person or the group of people, nobody really knows who the actual creator was, whether it was an individual or a group of people. But this became known as the Satoshi Nakamoto.
So that's actually an alias, possibly for a group or somebody else. It's not actually who. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and so after seeing the Great Recession in 2008, these guys got together with Satoshi Nakamoto to create Bitcoin. And it's funny because the first thing that was written in the very first Bitcoin that was mined was, I think it was the 3rd of March. It literally said, 3rd of January 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. So there was a big inspiration from the latest bust.
So you're saying that was written into the code?
Yes.
Blimey. So so that really is pointing a direct link between the boom and bust cycle of this invented currency, which they call fiat currency, right?
Yes.
The currency that you and I are used to carrying in our pockets as paper with the Queen's head on. And so there's a direct correlation, you're saying, between that kind of currency and Bitcoin as a reaction to its weaknesses.
Yes.
Right. I had no idea. Okay. Okay. So the problem they were trying to solve was, how are they going to solve that problem then?
So the purpose of Bitcoin was to create something as close to gold as possible, but a digital version of gold. That was the original intention that the creator or creators had. So gold has some core traits. For example, it's scarce. So fiat, for example, is not scarce anymore. Gold is durable. It's portable, it's divisible, you can break gold down if you can melt it. It's verifiable, so you can check if the gold is 99.9% accurate or not. You can store it. So these cryptographers, economists, and programmers got together and built Bitcoin to mimic the properties of gold. So Bitcoin is limited in the sense that only 21 million Bitcoins will ever be created.
21 million?
Yes.
How did they get that number?
I have no idea. but yeah, they picked 21 million. Maybe it's related to some algorithm or some mathematical sequence or something in history. I can't remember. Okay. But it was 21 million as the scarcity. It's portable because you can carry in a wallet. It's divisible, so one unit of Bitcoin has a lot of zeros behind it, so you can divide it. It's verifiable, and it's hard to counterfeit because it's got a unique encryption algorithm. And so that was the plan. But the advantage of creating Bitcoin over gold is that you don't need to carry Bitcoin physically. You just need to memorize a private key, a long string, and that you can retrieve your Bitcoin holdings from anywhere in the world.
Okay, so a key is like a password.
Yes.
Cool. All right. So basically what you're telling me is regular money has these cycles because it's inherently unstable, because of the effect that we talked about with debt and interest and being unable to repay.
Yeah.
And regular money is fiat, and certainly the modern day money. So I know that the dollar came off the gold standard in the 70s, right?
Yes.
Something like that. So it's not even backed, but it's only backed by goodwill now. Given that this is a cyclical thing, the Bitcoin people, the inventors, the guy, they tried to solve this problem by creating a fake, like not a fake, an ersatz digital gold product. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so it works through... So how does it practically work? I mean, we talked about a little bit about public keys, which I've tried to translate for the listeners as a password, but that's probably not entirely accurate, is it? It's built on something called blockchain. Can you just tell us a little bit about that? 40 yeah, so, minutes into the podcast.
Yeah, sorry, it's a fascinating subject.
Oh, man, yeah.
So the blockchain, I'll try and explain this in layman terms and just keep it short and sweet. You can Google blockchain and you'll find a lot of information there. The blockchain is basically a distributed ledger. So you can go onto blockchain.info and you'll see a ledger there, which records all the transactions ever made on the Bitcoin network.
No way.
The interesting thing about this is you make a transaction, person A makes it to person B, it'll be recorded in the blockchain when a miner processes it and takes their reward for it. And then that...
A miner being somebody who is trying to create Bitcoins.
Yes.
So M-I-N-E-R. So I heard miner, like some child.
Yeah, a Bitcoin miner, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it'll when the transaction is made from person A to B, it'll be published on the blockchain once the miner has settled it. And that copy of the blockchain will be available to every participant on the blockchain network. So say if that ledger gets corrupted by participant one on the network, you've got a million other participants who have the old copy. So you can never, it keeps the integrity of every transaction. And so.
Wait. So sorry, you were saying, and I'm just thinking back, this is, I get, so you've got the distributed ledgers so that everybody has got a copy of history. So probably yes. That's a really, really big file. Yeah. But, I pay you some Bitcoin.
Yeah.
In order to process that transaction, a miner, so somebody who is trying to create Bitcoin on their computer, running a Bitcoin mining program, gets rewarded somehow. Is that right? Did I understand that correctly?
Yes.
So how do they get rewarded? What do they get?
So
get Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I think you get a block, and then in that block are a certain number of Bitcoins.
Okay, so what happens when the system is max capacity? So you hit your 21 million possible Bitcoins and it's no longer possible to mine. What is the incentive then to do any of the transactional processing in the system?
That's where it gets interesting, because the more people that join the Bitcoin network and compete to mine, the more expensive it becomes to do it, and the more the value of Bitcoin rises, and the more difficult it also gets to mine Bitcoin. And so that...
Does that mean it's exponential? It's exponential? It's impossible to actually create all the Bitcoin there is out there?
It is possible, but it becomes harder and harder, because the difficulty gets adjusted every few years.
Right, and how does that get adjusted? Who adjusts it? It's automatic.
Yes.
See, can you tell? Like, I still feel very central bank, don't I? I still can't get my head around that this is supposedly a democratic... There's got to be some guy sitting back just cackling and doing what the Monopoly Man central bank caricature would be doing if this were paper money. Surely this has got to be a scam somehow, no?
No, this is just... It's free market competition. Whoever is able to mine can mine. And whoever mines the fastest... With the best machines gets the reward.
Yeah, so mining is... So I install I can install a Bitcoin mining program on my computer, right? And I can just run it and...
No.
No?
Yeah, well, you'll need really specialized hardware to do it, and they're called mining rigs, and they cost upwards of $1,000-$2,000 because of they're very advanced.
Okay, so they're quite processor intensive.
Yes.
In fact, I'm rocking on my computer that I'm recording this on now. I'm rocking a graphics card that I bought 3 years ago. And I remember someone saying, that's a really good Bitcoin mining graphics card, because back then you could shift processing onto the... You could share it between the CPU, the main processor, and the graphical processing unit, the GPU. So maybe I should give that a go and see if I can become filthy rich. But presumably then there are all these people who are chasing... This is like the gold rush, yeah?
Sort of. It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, so there are all these people, presumably, and you could take this to the extreme, building, filling their garage full of computers, mining Bitcoin.
There are people like that, yeah.
So, man, we must be spending a lot of money on electricity.
Yes. Do you want to take a guess how much we are using that on Bitcoin?
I bet whatever I say, it's going to be, I don't know, in terms of what? In terms of money or power? Or as
both.
A share?
Both.
Oh, my word. I don't even know where to start thinking. This is like one of those questions you get if you go for a job at Google, right? You know, why are manhole covers round? So I really wouldn't even know where to start with that.
So currently, mining Bitcoin is currently costing 60 trillion watts per hour. And that is the equivalent of 0.3% of the total electricity consumption in the world, which is about $1.5 billion a year. So it's not, economically sustainable system at the moment, which is why other things are coming into fruition, like proof of stake instead of proof of work. So proof of work is a miner is doing complicated work to process your transaction, whereas proof of stake is where a person can mine or validate a transaction according to how many coins they hold. So there's a lot of research and development going into proof of stake rather than electricity hungry proof of work.
There's clearly some kind of governance authority here that's looking after the protocols for Bitcoin, right? That's managing this in the same way that you've got it for managing how the internet works.
No, it's anyone. So how it works is a developer can change the open source, the software code of Bitcoin, but it needs to be validated and verified by various other participants before it's accepted. There's a kind of a governance that takes place to accept a change on Bitcoin, and you need a certain percentage of participants to accept big changes, otherwise the change doesn't go through. So it's
okay.
It's,
that's
it's
really democratic. And the other thing I'm trying to wrap my head around is how much electricity not only does Bitcoin consume, but how much electricity we are creating as a species currently. That is mental. Really, 60 trillion watts per hour is used, and that's only 0.3% of our hourly electricity consumption. Is that right?
Well, that's what I found after a bit of research.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Amazing. Well, yeah. Just the scale of what we're doing as a species is nuts. Imagine if we put all of this thinking into colonizing Mars, right? What would we be doing? Well, we'd be on Mars, I guess is the answer. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think I've understood the problem it's trying to solve, roughly how it hangs together. That's kind of democratic. How do I buy it? how do I sell it? Because that's what people seem to be doing. How do I hold it?
Sure. So you can buy it on Bitcoin exchanges. So there are popular ones, really user-friendly ones like Coinbase.com. There is Bitstamp. There is Kraken. There are others. So you can buy it there. You can deposit your dollars or your pounds or your euros and go on the open marketplace and buy Bitcoin there. Mm-hmm. And then you can deposit that into your exchange wallet. The exchanges will give you a wallet, which will contain a public key. You won't see the private key, I think. And then you can transfer bitcoins from that wallet to any other wallet. So that's how you would buy it. And conversely, if you want to sell it, you would deposit your bitcoins into the exchange wallet and go into the open marketplace and sell Bitcoin and get fiat currency back for it. But not a lot of people are doing that at the moment.
Well, I guess since the value sunk, so the value's dropped quite a lot, right?
Yes.
So talk us. So in the intro, I talk about how you surfed the wave, right? Mm-hmm. So you've been. So this kind of all got you interested, right? Tell me more about how you got into it, and kind of a little bit about. Tell us about the history of the market and maybe your place in it, if you know what I mean. I'm not asking you to tell me about your position or anything, but. You know, when did you get in and why? And, you know, it's one thing reading all this stuff, another thing doing it and taking the plunge.
Sure. So, as I mentioned before, I got quite interested in how money works in 2008, 2009. And then I couldn't get a job, a graduate job for a whole year after I came out of uni in the recession.
Right.
So I had quite a lot of free time to read up on things like this. But eventually, when I did land my first job, I kept one eye on all this stuff. And I got interested in gold stocks. Being the speculative person I am, and the way I went about as a complete novice, I bought some stocks and I didn't do very well. I lost my house deposit. It was a new experience. It was a very steep learning curve. I lost a lot of 90% of my house deposit in gold mining stocks when the gold market crashed in 2011. And so I still kept one eye out on the market, because after reading about the money system, I just wasn't convinced that this was a sustainable way to store wealth. So anyway, I worked, a few jobs here and there. I started researching on web technologies and fintech, and I bumped into blockchain technology in January of last year. And, I couldn't wrap my head around blockchain technology. It was just too advanced for me at the time. Every time I tried to read the Ethereum white paper, my mind was just blown, and I just gave up after 5 minutes. But I kept going back to it, and basically, I think Ethereum went to $10 per Ethereum coin. And then I remember I was sat in the office in Kainos. At work, and it jumped to $40 a coin, and then I couldn't understand what was going on, and then it jumped to 80.
This was just for the record, this was on your lunch break, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So it jumped to $80, and then eventually it jumped to $400, and that just piqued my interest. Like, why has this thing jumped so quickly? Then I've saw all these partnerships that were forming around the Ethereum ecosystem. So I got into, I made my first purchase around June, July on Coinbase.com. I bought my first Bitcoin there. And then
did you buy a whole Bitcoin or what did you do?
I bought, I think, two bitcoins at the time. They were only worth $2,500 each, I think. But I also bought a lot of Litecoin, which is the silver to the Bitcoin's gold, as they say.
Okay.
And Litecoin was recently released on Coinbase, that very popular website, and that's when I realized that there could be a similar run to Litecoin as there was to Bitcoin. So I started in June last year, June, July, and then I discovered ICOs and other derivatives of Ethereum, because you can raise capital using Ethereum tokens. And so I started looking at the places where the risk and reward, the reward to risk ratio is really good. So if you risk a little, if you risk a certain amount, the chances of you making are far greater than the chances of you losing. So I thought the smartest play to make would be to buy shares in new emerging Bitcoin exchanges that were running on Ethereum. And so I bought stakes in a company called Binance. I bought stakes in a crypto to fiat credit card called 10x.
Mm-hmm.
And within a week or two, I just... These weren't percentage increases. These were multiples, the returns I was getting. But because I'd seen from past experience that what goes up also comes down very quickly.
You got out of Dodge with the money, right?
Yeah.
Tell me you got out of Dodge. Good.
Yes.
Good. So then we had, and so you were telling me starting around the summertime, then you went in and out of different cryptocurrency products, Bitcoin, Litecoin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then I remember it got really crazy around about Christmas time.
Yeah.
And then it seems to have cooled off. So do you know what's behind that?
Yeah, so I did a bit of research and I spoke to a few people. I think what happened, a few hedge funds got together and they realized that Bitcoin is on the verge of becoming mainstream, and so some funds in Japan and Korea got involved, and they made some big buys before Christmas, which caused a big spike. So you can safely say that early mainstream adoption is coming, because this big money rolled in and everything literally just quadrupled and pentupled over Christmas with this short spike.
So the institutions came in, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
And now they're left with cap in hand or something, because so the value's kind of halved, right, since Christmas time.
In some cases, it's dropped 80%, but it's recovered a lot as well over the last week or two. I think the people who've been in this these situations before have probably known when to, you know, walk away with what they've made versus people who are very new. So one thing to notice is that the volume volume and trading wasn't very high at the tail end of last year, so there was a bit of market manipulation in setting the price high.
And that was you, right? You were on a forum or two giving a tip. You know I'm going to inevitably ask you for a tip at some stage.
Sure.
So you've got these Bitcoins and you can trade them back and forth like those football stickers that you collect in an album?
Yeah.
Can you actually buy anything with them?
Yeah, so there are a few retailers accepting Bitcoin. So apparently there are about between 50 and 100,000 retailers that accept it. But not a lot of them are mainstream. So I know Microsoft accepts it in some form, shape or form. Expedia accepts it. There are companies like BitPay, which will take your Bitcoin and convert it into fiat money when you make a purchase. But the main Bitcoin acceptance is growing. But I think the bulk of it is through Bitcoin to fiat credit cards at the moment.
Okay, and so, but you can use it, I guess, if I wanted to buy a car off you, you know, I wanted to buy your car, I could, if you were to accept, I could pay you with Bitcoin from my Bitcoin wallet, and you'd be like, yeah, that's fine, give me, I don't know, half a Bitcoin or whatever the car's worth, right?
Yeah, there are people out there who are doing that, yeah.
So, so that brings up, like, interesting implications, firstly around tax, but then also presumably around contraband. So maybe going on the dark, I could go on the dark web, presumably, and I could buy drugs if I wanted with Bitcoin. I'm not, by the way, just for the record, not advising that people either buy or consume drugs, but I'm trying to think of something that you might buy on the dark web. Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, that's what Bitcoin's been largely associated with when it was a very low price. It's. I think the dark web did propel it into a niche kind of mainstream visibility, but obviously a lot of drugs and smuggling is also done using hard cash. So
yeah,
there is that.
So earlier you said, I think, that because of this central register, every coin transaction is recorded. So what? How can I have my transactions anonymous? Can I have my transactions anonymous?
With Bitcoin, you can't.
Uh-huh.
So Bitcoin is not anonymous because every transaction amount, the source address, destination address, it can be seen by anyone who goes onto the blockchain. There are anonymous cryptocurrencies out there, and there are some very interesting developments coming out at the moment. So there's one being heavily sponsored by JP Morgan, which is called Zcash.
Mm-hmm.
But the founder of Zcash, the actual person leading the development, he is a public. He is visible in public circles, so there is a threat that he's a single point of failure. So someone could, you know, blackmail him into creating a backdoor. I don't know how anonymous that is. But then there are other coins like Monero, which are known to be fully anonymous because no one knows who's developing it, and it's got very interesting protocols driving that currency.
So where would you see the future of this? I don't know what you'd even call it. I don't want to call it an asset class, but I guess I did in the intro call it an asset class. But I don't even know if that's the right word, given that I'm still trying to understand that it's a thing. What's the future? Will there be? There seems to be a lot of competition. Like, we used to have a lot of competition in personal computing. Yeah, we used to have a lot of different computer platforms, and ultimately, it fell down to Microsoft and Apple, pretty much. But Microsoft dominating. So is the same kind of effect going to happen here with cryptocurrencies?
Absolutely. I mean, Kieron, have you ever read up on the railroad bubble that happened in America?
Do you know what? Mm-hmm. I came today being ready to think aloud about the tulip bubble and about the South Sea bubble, but not the railroad bubble. It was this to buy stocks in railroad companies, presumably?
Yes, yeah. Yes. The railroad bubble created, there were thousands of companies in that bubble, and only a handful survived. What's going to happen, I think, in the Bitcoin space is, of course, there will be thousands of protocols, ideas. There will be lots of people trying to scam people for money. There will be lots of copycats. There will be lots of very, very small solutions asking for lots of capital. But inevitably, the ones that evolve and meet certain needs. For example, Bitcoin is not scalable at the moment, let's be honest. It takes half an hour to send a Bitcoin, and when the network gets very busy, it can take a lot longer.
Mm.
So there are new protocols out there built on the blockchain that are addressing this scalability issue, and those are now gaining a lot of value and a lot of traction. So they're addressing the scalability gap. There will be tokens out there, companies out there, who will be SEC compliant, FCA compliant, because the originators, the progenitors like Ethereum, were not really SEC compliant and were actually waiting for a hearing on the 7th of May to find out if Ethereum is a currency or if it's a security. So a lot of companies are going to come out, and they will, and new ones will come and fill in gaps, and eventually the musical chairs will stop and someone will be accepted and will have picked up, addressed all the flaws that its predecessors didn't. And I think that's how this will go.
So we're saying there's going to be a gradual whittling down. Something will get legitimized with regulation, right?
Yeah.
And then won't it just become co-opted by the power structures that created the Fed in the first place and then used maybe to be part of the problem it was trying to solve? Is that possible? Or is it impossible, but given the technology?
In my heart, deep down, I think the more things change, the more they stay the same.
We're back to that. Plus ça change.
Yes. However, there are people out there, entrepreneurs out there, libertarians out there, who are working very hard to keep the reason for the existence of blockchain alive, keep it decentralized but scalable. So there is a lot of work going into this. Some of the world's brightest minds are leaving the Googles and the Facebooks and the Ubers and even AI to concentrate on keeping the core values of blockchain strong and pop mainstream. So a lot of work is happening behind the scenes to keep it like that. And I'm already looking at new companies. If they address one little gap and a rumor comes out that they've partnered with someone to make it more viable, the stock just doubles or triples. There's a lot of money still in the market, and there's a lot of money still supporting these ideas. So people are strongly incentivized to keep the idea of decentralization alive.
So there is, yeah, and so there's a good incentive. Still seems, as you say, a bit of mania.
Yeah.
Still probably a bit of a bubble.
Yeah.
Yeah. So neither of us are financial advisors. So be very, very careful. Your home is at risk, blah, blah, blah. But I have to ask, probably before we move on to our secondary topic for today, which is gambling. There's probably a reason we pick gambling, but I'm sure we'll work that out shortly. Can you tell anybody what the next hot pick is going to be?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I haven't heavily invested in this, so I kind of feel a bit bad that I'll let this one out and I'll miss the train myself. But there is a company called Nucleus Vision. So this company is backed by some legends in the industry. One of them is called Tim Draper. He was the first person to predict Bitcoin at 10,000. He's been a very successful investor. So Nucleus Vision, what this company does is it will know who... I know this sounds slightly George Orwell 1984, but it will know who you are as soon as you walk through the door. It will. They've patented this technology called what is it called? I can't remember. It's something to do with the near field. the Ion, I-O-N. It's a similar concept to RFID Wi-Fi, but it's not none of those. So when you walk into a store, it will know who you are, and it will incentivize you just for being in the store or for making a purchase. It will automatically incentivize you. It will pay you some tokens. And all transactions will be done on the blockchain. So when you earn these tokens, you can redeem these anywhere in the world. You don't have to convert them. You'll be able to exchange them. Well, you will be able to exchange them for another crypto. But the appeal with this one is that it will know who you are and incentivize you according to your profile, and everything will be done on the blockchain. You'll have access to 24/7 crypto markets, and it's partnering with a lot of big companies, in starting with India first, and it's got people from Harvard, Levi's, some very, very big names are trying to incentivize you just walking into a store, just interacting with offline products, to de-digitize you, so to speak, but incentivize you at the same time.
Okay, so presumably people can just Google that and find out a way of getting in.
Amazing. Yeah, so you can go on Nucleus.vision, and I think the market cap is below $200 million. And other companies with this kind of ambition have gone from like 200 million to like 3 or 4 billion in a matter of 6 months. It's the network effect that's going to generate the value. So they've got a lot of partnerships coming up. So it's an exciting one to look out for.
Great. Well, hey, thank you very much for dipping the toe into Bitcoin. I think this could have gone on for hours and hours and hours. And in fact, I think we're probably running a little bit ahead or over time. But why don't we just touch on our secondary topic, because, you know, we promised. So why have we chosen gambling? I mean, it's a pretty obvious link, isn't it? Talking about Bitcoin, talking about what you've just talked about there with a potential pick. It's not a huge leap of the imagination to go to gambling, is it?
Absolutely not. It's it uses the same emotions. It's the same kind of speculation. You know, gambling is wagering on something that's uncertain. And the early stages of this Bitcoin or blockchain revolution, there is a lot of uncertainty. And gambling can be 24/7, which is what blockchain is. And it gives you the advantage of more events and markets to speculate in, but you can also suffer burnout and a lot of loss. So, there are a lot of commonalities.
So, you and I have both worked in the euphemistically named gaming industry in the past, right? So, you used to work for a relatively big branded gaming company, and so did I. And I guess we can probably share a few stories about what we've seen, but you know, now that online gambling or gaming, as I've said, it's euphemistically known, is available to people, do you think that's okay? Do we think we're putting temptation in people's way now? Does that sound a bit Puritan, that last sort of line of reasoning?
Well, I think everyone's entitled to their choices in life. It's we all learn from our mistakes, and some of us improve and some of us kind of give up. Gambling, I don't know how much of an art it is versus how much of a science it is, but it's you need to know your risk versus your reward. If you're betting on a good sports player who's been consistent, you might think that he or she'll probably win their next game, But also, if they've been winning so consistently, the chances of them losing also increase, because you can never win, you know, 20 games in a row, unless just the chances are so rare. So there is always that. I don't know. Nobody. Well, the thing is, you see, a lot of us, we live by ordinary, traditional routines. You know, we wake up, we go to work, we, you know, get angry at stuff, get excited about stuff, and we cultivate those emotions over a long periods of time, and those become our character. And we bring those characteristics with us when we gamble. Because, you see, no one's really born as a gambler or a speculator. And so when people bring those emotions into these markets, into this arena, they use that conditioning to help them participate. But
so maybe people, is it that people start off being quite risk averse, and then they gradually, their appetite for risk increases?
Well, you see, that's how it should be, but it never is.
Oh.
I think a lot of us, we get quite emotional. A lot of us will take small bets. That's also true. But the rational side of gambling or speculating isn't really it's not done by the majority of people.
No.
Otherwise it'd become very, very, it'd become a diminishing industry, because the house isn't winning, you're winning. So
it just makes me think of War Games, the movie with Matthew Broderick, back when he only probably just started shaving. And the conclusion of War Games was the computer simulator realizing the only way to win a nuclear war is not to play the game. So that's certainly been my attitude to gambling. Certainly the gaming company I worked at, we were all given 20 quid when we started. We were given an account with 20 quid. And I remember watching horse races, because we all had screens up over our desks, watching the horse races and then betting on a horse, but not betting on the horse on the screen, betting on the name of the horse, not on the TV, but on the monitor in the market, the in-play market, as the odds were changing, and putting the money as the odds shortened on that horse winning. And that actually, I thought, right, I found a system, and I know. This is where we get greedy, I think. I know what the answer is. I know the system. I think I can make this work. I tell you what, Sonny, I got a really uncomfortable feeling. You know, quite an adrenaline rush playing that. I didn't always win, otherwise I wouldn't, you know, I'd be somewhere else, right? but that really scared me, actually. That I felt as though I was on a cliff looking over the edge. And we had quite a sobering incident. We had, in our company, we had slot machines, casino-type slot machines. And this guy won £1 million.
Wow.
I think it was £1 million on the slot machines online. He won £1 million.
Wow.
And somebody walked around the office floor, said, somebody's just won £1 million on the slots. And we were like, oh, my God, that's amazing. Well, at least I said that. And my boss kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, that happens all the time. He'll have lost it by lunchtime. And sure enough, that same punter had lost it by lunchtime.
Wow.
Like, I don't know about you, but if I hit £1 million on a payout, I'm not going back in.
Well, you know? you're a very... You're not a very greedy person, Kieran.
Well, I don't know if it's that. It then made me think, maybe it's not that the person who lost the million after winning £1 million was greedy. He or she might have been desperate. £1 million might have been a drop in the bucket for what that person was on the hook for. That's the other thing I can't help thinking about, is the amount of debt. Oh, look, we're back to debt that people get into with this gambling stuff. Yeah. So there's, but there's a fear of missing out, right? If you don't, yeah. If only I'd bet on Liverpool to make the Champions League final, mm-hmm. you know, then I could retire. So yeah, how does that work?
So there's two terms I've got quite accustomed to over the last few months, I think. One is FOMO, which is fear of missing out. And the other is the herd mentality. Mm-hmm. So it's funny that you spoke about the horses with the best names or memorable names. Some of the cryptocurrencies that I've been looking at over the last 6 months or so have risen astronomically because they had a really catchy name.
No.
Yeah. One of them was called Verge, and you don't want to know how quickly that went up. It went, it's disgusting. It went from, I don't know, in the tens of millions to over $1 billion, Kieron. Over a billion.
What? So, hang on. Verge.
Yes, Verge.
V-E-R-G-E.
Yes.
Like the edges around your lawn.
Yes.
Sorry, but hang on. You just told me. So that was clearly not one of the catchy ones.
Well, people like the name. A lot of nerds, they love that name.
Right.
There's a lot of edgy people in crypto, so...
So can I create a cryptocurrency called Paving Slab or something and then make a fortune? Breeze Block. There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, Breeze Block. B-L-O-C. Breeze Block.
Yep. Anything is possible. So, I saw a lot of that FOMO. Fear of missing out when coins were breaking out of historical price ranges and just going into the stratosphere, and if the daily volume, say a buying and selling volume on a coin was, I don't know, 100,000 one day, and then it just broke out of a special price range, it would go to, you know, volumes of 1 million, 10 million, even $200-300 million in a single day.
Crikey.
And that was clearly the herd mentality, that, you know, one person is, or a bunch of people have initiated this thing. Maybe they've got together with other people, or something big is about to break out in terms of like a big mainstream adoption or partnership announcement with a big established IT player or someone. Someone will take the price to another level. It could be a small increment, and then it just goes up. It just follows the pattern of an avalanche, and then you see absolutely brand new investors who just bought their first Bitcoin or whatever, trying to buy these alternative cryptocurrencies and getting excited about that ridiculous rise, buying it all the way at the top, just when it's about to go down, and learning things the hard way.
That's really sad. Yes. That it sucks to be them. I read a funny. I remember when I sold the. So I bought a couple of Bitcoin, as I mentioned earlier, on a. Not a couple of Bitcoin. What am I talking about? Micro Bitcoin. So a fraction of a Bitcoin. And I bought that at this ATM. And then I sold it just before Christmas, actually. And then kicked myself because I saw the price double since I sold it, and then crash again. Mm-hmm. And I remember, but I remember tweeting when I sold it and saying, I've sold my Bitcoin and I'm now going to invest my money in tulips and a company that's doing very interesting work in the South Seas. and it was a stupid reference to obviously the Dutch tulip mania, where, I don't know, tulips became the most expensive speculative item. I don't even know which century that was. And then the South Sea bubble that sort of peaked around 1720. Mm-hmm. And there was a famous investor in that peak. We were talking just now about investing at peak. So mm-hmm. that was Newton, right?
It was indeed Mr. Isaac Newton.
So not a thickie. But the story that I heard was kind of sad, right? Because he actually got in near the floor.
Yes.
And then he got out near the top, and then thought, "Hang on, this is still going up." So he bought at the peak, and then it crashed out.
Yeah. So
that's FOMO in the extreme. Yeah. Yes. Sorry.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm just looking at where I'm on the internet, and I'm looking at the price history of the South Sea stock bubble where Newton bought in and sold. He buys in the floor. He buys a step higher. Then he buys. Then his friends get rich. And then he puts everything in, almost everything in, a few steps after his friends get rich. And then the whole thing crashes, and then he sells at the bottom.
So I feel really, you know, we've taken quite a journey there around the philosophical basis for why money works the way it works. By money, I mean real money rather than Bitcoin, and what Bitcoin was supposed to be the answer, or the question that Bitcoin was trying to answer, that money posed. So that was really, really interesting, really massively detailed in terms of the history. I had no idea, really. And thank you also for telling us a little bit about actually how Bitcoin works, and also a hot tip there. And we wrapped up by talking about gambling that, oddly enough, brought us back to Bitcoin. So I don't know if that's a warning or just something interesting. Thank you so much. My head kind of hurts after all that, and I think I'm going to have to lie down in a dark room before I hit the publish button on this podcast. There'll be show notes available. So a lot of the subjects that we touched on have got quite a lot of reading behind them, so we'll have them published. And we'd be really keen to hear from you. Just hit us up on Twitter at LDN Podcast. Sonny, you've got a Twitter presence as well, stuffed with graphs.
Yes, I do. You can find me on at Sonny Dilgear.
Brilliant. Excellent. And also, if needed, you can all find that on our site, and there'll be links to it inside the show notes. So that's us. Sonny, thank you very much for joining me on the virtual studio.
I'm flattered to be on it, so thank you.
It's been emotional.
Likewise, Kieran, likewise.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.